I'd like to turn us this morning first to 1 Corinthians chapter 8, which is where we will be spending the majority of our time. And then if you find that, put your finger there and hold your place there, and we will turn to another place, Exodus chapter 20. Exodus 20. Now, some of you who know your Bibles, we're going to open with the Exodus passage. Some of you who know your Bibles know as soon as I said Exodus 20, you said, oh, the Ten Commandments. And that's exactly right. That's the chapter where Moses meets Israel and identifies them as his people and identifies himself as their God. Sometimes we forget. Let me set the tone for you, because in the first two commandments, which is where we're going to look, there are some things said which bear heavily on what we're going to learn in 1 Corinthians 8. When the Lord drew Israel out of Egypt and brought them to Mount Sinai, they were not people who really knew him. They were basically idolaters. They'd been raised in Egypt and had been a slave nation within Egypt for several hundred years. They knew that they belonged to God in some sense, but had no idea what the shape of that really looked like. And they treated Yahweh pretty much like any other god. He was just their particular brand, right? Well, of course, that's completely wrong. They didn't know it was wrong, but after the Lord miraculously delivered them from Egypt, and they were very impressed with all of this, we're talking the 10 plagues, the whole enchilada, all the way out to the desert, the mountain, the impressive scene that they faced. He introduces himself to them, and in doing so, he actually frightens them so badly that they, I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but they said, don't talk to us yourself, let Moses talk to us. And that's how Moses got the job. Actually, the Lord had drafted him earlier than that, but Moses ends up speaking for to the people for God. But the original Ten Commandments were spoken audibly from the mountain. And it's the Lord saying to them, this is who I am, it's who I've been all the way along, and this now is who you are because you belong to me. One way to see it is as something of a wedding ceremony in which the Lord has rescued his bride from an evil tyrant, carried her across the water in his own arms, put her down in the desert at the foot of this mountain, and there's something of a ceremony in which he says, I am committing my life to you. And as a matter of fact, he'd been committed to Israel since before Israel knew it. And he says, and by the way, you're committing your life to me as well. And this mutual commitment, you will see, is extremely exclusive. It's intimate, it's powerful, and it is exclusive. They had been raised to believe that there are many gods, and you can take your pick. And he says, no, there is one God, it's me, and you belong to me. It's not that you just volunteered, it's that I brought you into existence, and you belong to me, and I belong to you. It goes both ways. Very powerful stuff. It's this intimate relationship that is a covenant relationship. Now, with that in mind, hear what he says, and we're only going to cover the first couple down to verse 5. Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before or in front of or more important than me. That's the idea. That's commandment number one. There is no other God, and you will worship only me. Commandment number two, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. Whatever you see or whatever you imagine to be in heaven, whether it's a star or an angel or whatever, you will not make a physical representation of it for the purpose of praying to it as though it represented me. You will not do that. You will not use any physical representations and pray to them as though they were me. Whether it's in the heavens or whether it's something in the creation on the earth or whether it's something in the water, whatever it is, if it's part of the creation, you mustn't use it as something to pray to. What he's saying is, don't mix me up with anything else. And don't take your theology from anything on earth. You take your theology just from me. I'm the one who gave you this whole thing, and I made the earth. Don't worship the stuff. Verse 5. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. It's a troublesome verse. People read it and they wonder what it means. What it means is this. When we raise our children, human beings, when human beings raise their children in idolatry, they are teaching them to hate the real God. And to the extent that they teach them to hate the real God or ignore him, to that extent, the real God will be their adversaries down through the generations. There are no words ever spoken more sobering. This is shocking to people, that God simply has the audacity to say, I am God, and you will worship me and me alone. And to say it to people who thought they had plenty of gods to go around. Thank you very much. A group of people who had no idea what they had gotten into. They were glad to be rescued, but had no idea that this was so exclusive. I mean, in their knapsacks that they brought from Egypt, they had idols. They melted them down and they used them to make the golden calf very shortly after this. What he says here is so radical, so different. Now, you've been raised in monotheism, and you know at least something about the Ten Commandments. But you must understand that when these people heard this for the first time, it revolutionized everything they were ever to believe. That religion is not a pluralistic enterprise, that there is one God, and that he takes very personally the idea that there are other gods, and he knows, first of all, it's not true, and secondly, it's disloyal to him who is our creator. Very, very heavy things. He outlines the basis of idolatry here. That's what he's doing. And he's pointing out to them that they had actually been, for the most part, idolaters. Don't get any warm, fuzzy ideas about what Israel was like when they were slave labor. The first generation had a fairly good understanding. Joseph and the fam. Something of a good understanding. By the time Moses came on the scene, and by the time these events take place, these people are, well, vastly ignorant of who God is. When he calls them and he says to them, I am in a sense marrying you and you're marrying me, almost immediately they made the golden calf. Thinking they were doing something good, they browbeat Aaron while his brother Moses was up on the mountain talking to God. Aaron got pressured by the people into making the golden calf. So right there at the wedding ceremony, they're kissing the groom's best friend. Well, actually, the groom's enemy. And it is that exact idolatry that he is saying, don't do this. And he is radically grasping their attention. They didn't grasp it right away. And in fact, it took them generations to finally realize how serious he was about this. Idolatry became the main problem in Israel, bar none. It was the main problem in Israel up until the Babylonian captivity. If you know what the Babylonian captivity is, that's excellent, because it's a huge chunk of the Old Testament. It is the main discipline that God brought against Israel because of idolatry. Because of not obeying these first two commandments, because of being disloyal to their husband, their groom, so to speak, because of turning away to other gods. And when you understand how serious he is about it, you realize how important then the subject of idolatry becomes, especially in the Old Testament, but also in the New. Idolatry is a major, major issue. In the Old Testament, idolatry took two basic forms. there was what we would call crass or blatant idolatry, which is essentially worshiping another god. I mean, we're talking kill an animal, stone idol right there, or wooden idol, or go find some altar someplace in the woods, kill something, pour the blood out on it. We're talking crass idolatry. And all the different kingdoms of the areas of these lands had their own gods. They all worshipped him, almost all with blood sacrifices of one sort or another, some even human sacrifices. The people were raised with this. It was in their blood. It was in their thinking. It was so common to them that the idea that God should say, don't do that anymore, was radical. I mean, it was like, whoa, how can this be? This blatant form of idolatry was what tempted Israel for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. When they got into Canaan, they adopted the Canaanite deities. And you say, well, why did they do such a thing? I mean, after being at Sinai and everything. It's because their culture had raised them to be this way. It's very difficult to change the direction your culture has taught you since you were little. And when they went into other nations, they thought it was the right thing to do to worship the nations of that God in addition to worshiping Yahweh. And God says, you try to do that, you're not worshiping both of us, you're worshiping him. And they were saying, why can't we worship both of you? They never got it through their heads how exclusive this is. They believed in a thing called, this blatant idolatry was a thing called henotheism, or we call it henotheism. It means that there is a God over every country. And when you come to that country, you honor that God. It's like using their currency. You know, you go to a country, you use their currency. You take a little dictionary, learn their language or whatever. Well, when you go to a country in those days, you worship their God. You go over to Babylon, for instance, you worship Marduk and a dozen others that they had. Or you go to Phoenicia and you worship Baal. Or you go to Canaan and you worship Baal, or you worship Molech, or whatever. There's a bunch of different names, all these different fertility gods. And they thought, well, they each have their own territory. And that's why when they went to these areas, it was so natural for them to say, well, why not worship, you know, Baal here, or Baal here, or, you know, so-and-so. And the Lord was forever trying to get them to realize there really is only one, and it really is only theirs, and how jealous he was to deal with this. It was this blatant idolatry that caused such jealousy. Incidentally, he says, I'm a jealous God. That intensity, see? Kana. He was, that's the Hebrew word, he was so intent on the intimacy and the purity of the relationship that he would discipline them severely if they went to these other pagan deities. Well, this is what they did. Blatant idolatry almost from the beginning. Under Joshua, things worked out pretty well, but after Joshua, they wrestled with this idolatrous stuff in Canaan all along. And then after Solomon died, they did fine under David, and for the first half of Solomon's reign, but then after Solomon died in 930 BC, there was a civil war, and the people had fallen grossly into idolatry by that time. Crass idolatry under most circumstances. So you see this very clearly. And the Lord said, stop it. In fact, he was so patient. It took hundreds of years that they did this. And he would discipline them a little here and a little there. Until finally, he just said, that's enough. And he sent them into the Babylonians, 70 years away from their land before he brought them back. Now, the other kind, besides the blatant henotheistic kind of idolatry that was available in those days, was what is known as syncretistic idolatry. Syncretism is mixing things. When a syncretistic idea is, mixes the ideas that are around and forms a new one. Well, that was a form of idolatry too. After the Civil War, Jeroboam was the king in the north, the northern 10 tribes. And he invented a religion because he needed to keep the people together, and he couldn't let them go down to Jerusalem, and it was the capital of the south. So he wouldn't let them go there. So he invented a religion, and he called it Yahweh worship. He called it the worship of God, because he was dealing with Jewish people. So he invented a religion which we call the Jeroboam cult, and he built two temples, one in the south in Bethel, one in the north in Dan, and he modeled these temples after, guess what? The temple in Jerusalem. They were smaller, but they were modeled after that temple, except when you went inside, there were golden calves. The repetition of the same old thing. And he said, now you're worshiping God here. You're worshiping the real God, Yahweh, and yet it was golden calf worship. He even invented his own priesthood. I call it the bootleg priesthood. They weren't Aaronic priests. They weren't Levitical. They were not ordained by God. They were ordained by Jeroboam. But he said, nope, you're priests of God Most High. You're priests of Yahweh. He gave them their own sacrifices, gave them their own hymn book, gave them their own incense, gave them their own prayers. They even had their own false prophets. The kings in the north would listen to more false prophets. He said, where did they all come from? They came from the Jeroboam cult. And God never accepted it. Though they called it Yahweh worship, he knew it wasn't what he had actually said in his word. Now, that syncretistic form of idolatry was extremely powerful, especially in the north. You know, by the way, you can't just put God's name over just anything and call it real worship. It's not the name on the marquee. It's what's really being said about God. Is it his real covenant? And everybody wants to use God's name. It gives you credibility. But a lot of people use it in vain. That was the Jeroboam cult. So you see these things in the Old Testament. And it was this that drove the people into, well, brought them to a point where God said, I'm not taking this anymore. And he said, you're going to the Babylonian captivity for 70 years. And then he brought them back after that 70 years. And that's a story we're learning about a little bit on Wednesday nights. Well, the interesting thing is the Babylonian captivity worked. I don't know if you ever think about it this way, if you study it, but the Babylonian captivity drove idolatry from Israel permanently. Israel never again fell into Baal worship, never again fell into Phoenician fertility god worship after the Babylonian captivity. God's discipline really worked. And when they came back, they were determined, and you can read it in Ezra and Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, the prophets at the end of our English Bibles. What you find is that these prophets spoke to the people to rebuild the nation, rebuild the temple, and so on, because God had brought the people back. But they never fell into that idolatry again. Even by the time of Christ, another couple, actually 400 years went by, and even by that time, they had not fallen into crass idolatry or syncretism for the most part, but they had become very legalistic by the time Jesus came along. And that was when the Pharisees were flourishing and so on. And for other reasons, then, they missed the Lord's presence when he arrived. Nevertheless, they never went back to that idolatry. Now you move into the New Testament, thinking in terms of what is idolatry about? Well, when the gospel began to be preached after Jesus was crucified and resurrected and the Spirit was poured out and the gospel began to spread around the world, where do you think idolatry was once again encountered? Among the Gentiles. Not in Israel. Israel knew it. I mean, they had figured it out. We're not going to worship other gods. But among the Gentiles, there was rampant idolatry. And now we're right back to a group of people who were just like Israel when they were in Egypt, and just like the people all around the world throughout history who worship stuff instead of worshiping God. And so when the gospel got to these areas, especially under the Apostle Paul, it was being preached to Gentiles who were realizing they could come to know the real God without coming to Judaism. You guys following me so far? Are you with me? Okay, most of you are nodding, okay. Rest of you, we'll try not to talk too loud. We'll wake you up at the end. As this began to spread and as people began to come, they were now not coming repenting out of Judaism and trusting in Messiah, who they knew, and not coming out of a background of understanding how radically exclusive this relationship with God really is. They knew nothing of that. They came out of pluralistic pagan idolatry. So when they would come, they didn't realize what it took to really be loyal to the Lord. Part of what they dealt with when they came out was, what does this mean to be completely loyal to the Lord? What do you mean we can't worship a lot of different gods? And so one of the very first things that came up was this issue of loyalty, the first two commandments. Now, in the Roman Empire, every city had its own shrines, and they were all proud of them. They were like teams today have football teams, right? The bigger the city, the bigger the shrine, and everybody loved the local god. And for instance, in Ephesus, they worshiped Artemis, also known as Diana of the Ephesians, a fertility goddess. And when Paul preached there, so many people came to Christ and immediately got rid of all of their idolatry stuff because he was preaching. He was telling them, there's one God, get rid of this stuff. And they did. And it caused a ruckus in the economy because they had a big business in trinkets for Diana. and one of the blacksmiths, one of the guys who made the trinkets, one of the trinket wholesalers, and he wholesaled them all over the empire. His name was Demetrius. He started a riot, and they had a big deal about it. Why? Well, because people got saved and they realized no more Diana, and so business dropped, and it was a big problem. Well, in Corinth it was Aphrodite. Let's go to Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 8. See, the Corinthians were raised this way. They were raised in this idolatry. And the goddess that they worshipped was Aphrodite, a fertility goddess. But they also worshipped a lot. In fact, it was never exclusive. All of these gods tolerated the worship of other gods. Remember that the Lord God is the exclusive one. The rest of them were quite happy to share. As long as you made your sacrifice to them, everything was fine. And so they worshipped a lot of other gods. The big one in Corinth was Aphrodite. She had the Acro-Corinth. It was a great big temple up on top of the hill. She was their kind of patron saint, you might say, in the Greek pantheon. As that was developing, there were also many other gods being worshipped because it was such an international environment. And when they would come there, everybody would come to do business and make money. Corinth was a big money center. And so they'd bring their own gods. And they'd bring their god, they'd set up a shrine. They had over 26 holy sites, shrines and temples in the city of Corinth. And whenever you came to one of them, you would offer something up to that god. And it was no big deal. These people were raised with the idea that this was no big deal. Well, then came the gospel into this. And the Christian community began to grow. And these people had come out of idolatry and were being taught about loyalty to Christ. But they were taught, as they were being taught, they were taught that it doesn't matter what you eat as long as you are loyal to the Lord. Now, slow down here for just a minute, because there's something about the Corinthians, and in fact, most of the Roman cities, that's very important to understand. All the food, almost all of it, and especially all the meat in the community was sacrificed to a pagan god before it was sold. Now, the way that Jews dealt with this in all these communities was that they ate what? Kosher. They made sure that whatever they had was butchered by Jewish people who worshiped God and was not sacrificed to a pagan deity. And they were not going to break the second commandment or the first commandment by even giving any kind of credence to the idolatrous situation in the Roman Empire. But when these folks who'd been saved right out of this idolatry got saved, they didn't know where to get their meat. And so what happened was a rift developed, and a rift not just between the people, but between the people and Paul. He told them, you don't have to worry about what you eat. They said, cool, we never did in the first place. And what they went with that was, they said, so we'll just go ahead and eat whatever we want at whatever temple idol we want. And Paul said, I don't want you associated with idols. Don't you understand? This is a loyalty thing with you and God. And they said, yeah, but we can eat whatever we want. And this was the beef going on here. How many of you, a little pun, beef. How many of you have read ahead chapter 8? Only a few, okay. Oh, several. Okay, good. You got to read 8, 9, and 10. What he does is he deals with this issue in 8, 9, and 10. These people coming out of paganism, thinking, hey, we never worried about what we ate anyway. Why should we worry now that you're telling us all foods are clean? And what he's going to do is he's going to explain to them there's more to it than just the fact that all foods are clean. There's also an issue of idolatry. And in chapter 10, he says, you got to flee idolatry. You must never give the impression that you are willing to worship another god, ever. If you belong to Christ, you belong to God the Father. That's the same one that spoke the Ten Commandments. You must not be disloyal to him by worshiping a pagan idol. And all of this meat and all this food was given to the pagan idols. Furthermore, if you ate at a restaurant, most of the restaurants were attached to or connected with these idols. The reason was because the people who were the butchers creating the steaks and the roasts and the ribs and all the stuff they were eating had to kill the animals anyway, might as well kill them in honor of the patron god, right? So all the food was there. So they set up little restaurants adjacent to the temples, make a little money on the side. Well, that didn't bother anybody really, because they were pagans anyway and it didn't matter. But then you become a Christian, you think, well, can I eat that? And the old pagan idea was, sure, because who cares about idolatry? And Paul says, what you eat doesn't matter. But they took that and thought idolatry, therefore, didn't matter. So what Paul's doing in these three chapters is not primarily about liberty. It's primarily about idolatry and helping the Corinthians to realize there's more to this than just your liberty. There's also another issue. You mustn't be associated with idolatry. And you must not influence a person saved out of idolatry to go back into it. Because idolatry is a big thing. Well, I'm probably going to repeat myself about that a little bit as we go along. But let's dive in. I'll tell you, what he's going to say is, there's more to it than just your knowledge. The food is not the point. There's also certain brothers and sisters who don't know the difference and are going to think that idolatry is really okay. And he's pointing out that you can't give them that impression. Chapter 8 of 1 Corinthians, verse 1. Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. I'll put quotes around that phrase, we all have knowledge. Because this was, remember when we talked in chapter 7, how the Corinthians had these little jargon theology statements that they used, and Paul would write to them and he'd say, I know you think this, but here's how to interpret it and here's how to live it. This is one of their jargon statements. We all have knowledge, meaning we're monotheists, we're not pagans, we can do whatever we want. And their phrase was, we all have knowledge, we all have knowledge, we all have everybody, we all have knowledge. Well, coming out of paganism, this knowledge was putting them in a position where they were being associated with idolatry. And so Paul says, I know we all have knowledge, but knowledge makes arrogant. It's love that edifies. And you can see immediately what he's doing. Right now you're realizing, oh, it's another Corinthian arrogance. Absolutely. Corinthians were arrogant about almost everything about themselves. Their wisdom, the first few chapters. Their tolerance of sexual immorality, the next few chapters. Their, on the other hand, their strict views of sexuality under some circumstances in the next chapter that we looked at last time. Here, with their getting way too close to the idol stuff that's going on and hurting some people in the process. Their spiritual gifts in chapters 12, 13, and 14, all arrogance, just totally proud of what they knew or what they thought they knew. Paul says, okay, all right, I know we all have knowledge, but let me remind you, knowledge makes arrogant, love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. It's an interesting way to put it. You who think you know so much, let me remind you that the more you know, it should result actually in humility. The more you know you don't know. But there's an early point when you start to learn something where you begin to think you know it all. And that's where these people were, and it was hurting other people because of it. He says, if you think you know so much, you haven't really known. Let me remind you, verse 3, if anyone loves God, he is known by him. Wait a minute. What's he talking about? If anyone loves God, he's known by... He's using the word knowledge over and over. You have this knowledge, we have this knowledge, but the knowledge produces arrogance. Remember this, if you love God, he knows you. You know, we would think he would say, if you love God, you know him. He says the opposite. And it's not the last time he says some opposites here of what we would expect. He says, if you love God, he knows you. What's he getting at? He has a relationship with you. He's jealous for this relationship. He's very serious about it. He's very intense about it. He's got a zeal for this relationship that sometimes we don't have. And he's more serious about it than we are. He knows you. And that, the Corinthians should have been sitting there thinking, oh, hey, you mean it's not just about our knowledge? No, it's also about God's. What he knows is important. And he knows you. So sit up and pay attention. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there's no such thing as an idol. in the world, and that there's only one, there's no God but one. We know this. This is the knowledge, see? Even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods, these little g, you know, gods, and many lords, lots of temples, lots of paganism, lots of idolatry, yet for us there is but one God. And when it says for us there, it doesn't mean he's just our God and the rest of the gods have validity. That's not what he means. Not a pluralist. What he's saying is there really is only one God and we know it. You know it. I know it. We both know. We both know it. He's saying for us, we know. There is only one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and we exist for him. And there's one Lord, one Master, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and we exist through him. There's so much here. One God, one Son of God, who created everything. Christ created everything. And we exist for God through the Son. So he says, this is the knowledge. We know that this is true. By the way, always in Christian thinking and in Christian work, when we acquire knowledge, the purpose is to love. It's never simply to acquire the knowledge. Jot down 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 3 and following. Look it up when you get a chance. Paul says in 1 Timothy 1, verses 3 and following, he says, don't waste your time with foolish theological speculation. People don't know what they're talking about. It's interesting that he says that. Very applicable. He says, the goal of our instruction is love from a pure heart and a sincere faith. Love is always the practical outworking of real knowledge. Sometimes people will read what Paul says here and in other places about knowledge, and they'll say, well, then I'm going to be really spiritual. I'll make sure I don't learn hardly anything. And when it comes to learning theology or heavier things in my Christian life, I'll just say, well, you know, and they'll always quote the King James, you know, knowledge puffeth up and love edifieth. When people want to sound spiritual, often they will talk like the King James Bible. And you know, it knowledge puffeth up, and so I've decided not to acquire knowledge. But Paul never says not to acquire knowledge. The antidote for arrogance is not ignorance. The antidote for arrogance is humility. Because the more you know, the more you know you don't know. And the more a person knows, the more they're on their knees before God, or should be, saying to the Lord, my goodness, the more I learn about you, the more humbled I am, and the easier I am to get along with. Whoa. But it doesn't often work that way, because knowledge does produce arrogance in human beings. But the antidote for it, again, is not ignorance. We need to keep learning. The antidote for arrogance is humility. And so the Apostle Paul's not against learning. So notice what he says in the first six verses. He said, this is about love toward one another and loyalty. It's not just about your theoretical knowledge about what you can do with idol meat or idol food. By the way, for them, the word idol food was one word, and they knew what it meant. Idol food. It was all one word. And idol food was food that you knew was sacrificed to an idol. And they were raised with the idea that when you ate it and you chewed it and you swallowed it and it went into your tummy and you felt yourself being full, you were worshiping that idol the whole time. They were raised with it as idol food. And that's why in the next few things that he says, he has to make it very, very clear that their theoretical knowledge about God and Christ did not remove from them the responsibility to deal with what other people were thinking about idol food. Very powerful. It's about love and loyalty, not just about theoretical knowledge, verses 1 to 6. And remember what he says about one God. We'll get back to it. The next thing he says is verses 7 and 8. It's about the association with real idolatry. It is not about the food itself. Watch what he says. However, not all men have this knowledge, this understanding of who Christ is and the fact that food doesn't matter. Some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food, now underline this, as if it were sacrificed to an idol. Idol food. Idol meat. And they see it and they can't get it out of their heads. They see it as true idolatry, as if it were sacrificed to an idol. We know there's no idol. We know there's only one God, that these people are wasting their time. Later he's going to explain it's actually demons that are behind the idolatrous stuff. And we know that, but they don't. He says there's some people who've been raised with idolatry, and they can't look at that steak if they know where it came from. They can't see it as a clean thing. They just can't. And so he says, as they see it as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. We're going to see that there's a definition of a weak conscience that helps us understand the passage. But right now, just note what he's saying. Not everybody understands. Some people see this as real idol food. Now, the food itself doesn't matter, verse 8. Food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat, nor the better if we do. Very interesting. If we had longer time and we could have a discussion, I would point out, and we could maybe talk about it, that he says this in the exact opposite way that most Christians would expect. Read it again. The food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we do not eat it, nor the better if we do eat it. Most Christians who know a little bit, especially from the book of Romans and the Jewish food laws, would say this exactly the opposite way. They would say the food will not commend us to God. We are neither the worse if we eat it, nor the better if we do not eat it. That is the way most people who know a little bit of theology would understand the meaning of this. And Paul turns it around. Why? I'm having the discussion anyway, I guess, aren't I? Why does he say this? Why does he say it in the opposite way from the way most of us would expect? See, the Jewish food law says you can't eat such and so. So their thought was, I'm better if I don't eat stuff. And I'm worse if I do eat stuff. Paul is saying the exact opposite in this context. Why? Here's why. Because the Gentile idol worship, ex-idol worshipers who came to Christ were exercising their liberty this way. They were saying, we are better because we eat this meat. And he's saying, that's not true. You're not commending yourself to God by eating it or not eating it. If you decide not to eat it, you're not less spiritual. If you decide to eat it, you're not more spiritual. It's the exact opposite thing to what he says to the Jewish people. And here's why. It doesn't matter. Food doesn't matter. Hello. Food doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I sometimes talk to Christians and they'll say, well, you know, we don't eat, you know, we don't do that. And I feel like saying, I don't care. Well, you know, we do and we do this, and I want to tell him, I don't care. Why are you telling me? I don't care what you eat. I don't care what you drink. I don't care what you do half the time. Do you remember, anybody remember the movie The Fugitive? I don't recommend movies, and if you see me at one, I didn't see you, so. So, but in this movie, there's this scene in which the fugitive who was accused wrongly of a murder, right? And the marshal, the U.S. marshal's chasing him down. It's kind of what the movie's about. And the guy, the poor fellow who's been accused, is standing in this huge conduit. There's a bunch of water going through, and it's going to a waterfall. And he's about ready to escape by jumping out into the waterfall, you know, and this big dramatic thing. And the marshal's behind him, and they stop, and they're yelling to each other. And this guy who's been accused, he says, but I didn't do it. And there's this great line in which the marshal says, I don't care. And I remember it hit me because I thought to myself, well, of course the guy didn't do it. You ought to understand. And then I realized as soon as the marshal said that, I thought, well, he really doesn't care. Because it doesn't matter whether the guy did it at this point. It doesn't matter. Listen. When people are worried about food, the answer is, I don't care. Repeat that with me. I don't care. You know, I care what I eat. I don't care what you eat. Paul is saying to these people, it's not the food, but idolatry is a problem. That right there is the crux of 8, 9, and 10 of 1 Corinthians. This is the crucial distinction. If it were just about food, you could just go read Romans 14 and 15, eat what you want, don't criticize each other, leave it alone. But in Corinthians, now get this, it's not the same thing as Romans. It's not adiaphora. This is about idolatry. Do you guys remember the word adiaphora? You do? Okay, what does it mean? Stuff that doesn't matter. Good. You know, I get ragged on by certain people that I talk to from time to time. You guys must have told everybody that you know the word adiaphora, because I hear about it and they get, what did you, one of my friends, pastoral friends, what did you teach people the word adiaphora for? Stuff that doesn't matter. It's a good theological term. And I said, well, the folks in our church are able to handle words with more than two syllables. So, what about your church? So adiaphora is stuff that doesn't matter. And what happens in Romans is he says, to the Jewish and Gentiles arguing with each other about food, it doesn't matter at all. What he says to the Corinthians is, now catch it, really grasp this, you guys. The food isn't the issue. But there's more here than just the food. The idolatry with which the food has been associated in these people's minds for all this time, that is an issue. Because idolatry is an issue because the first two commandments are still true. You guys following that? Okay. Most people who misapply 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10 misapply it by thinking that it's identical to Romans 14 and 15 and it's adiaphora stuff. And that's only half true. The food doesn't matter, but the idolatry does. And what he's trying to get them to realize is that you limit your liberty sometimes to show your loyalty to Christ in some circumstances and to help other people who don't know any better, that to know that they need to also be loyal to Jesus so that their faith is not undermined and they don't become idolaters. You follow that? So that's why he says some people don't understand and it's not about the food, verse 8. And then the last major point is in 9 to 12, and he says it really is about the discipleship of some of these folks, these weak people with a weak conscience. Take care lest this liberty of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. See, the word liberty, boom, in our culture, Christians, liberty. Oh, this is about liberty. Actually, it's about idolatry. And the way liberty is used in an idolatrous situation, that's what these are all about. It's not primarily about liberty. It's primarily about idolatry. And once you get that, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I see where he's going. And you see in chapter 10 what he talks about in a whole different light. So he says, take care with the liberty. You don't want to stumble another person who's weak. Someone sees you who have knowledge, this knowledge, dining in an idol's temple. Remember the restaurants there at the idol place. Won't his conscience, if he's weak, have a weak conscience? Won't he be strengthened to eat things that are sacrificed to idols? He's an ex-idolater. He still thinks like an idolater. He doesn't think like a Christian yet. And if he goes in there, he drives by and he sees you eating at the God Denny has a restaurant. Denny's. And you drive by, he drives by, he sees you in there. And he always worshipped the God Denny. And now he doesn't anymore, but he sees you having dinner at Denny's where all the burgers have been sacrificed to Denny. And he says, I can't do this. Or maybe I can. Maybe, now get this, maybe it doesn't matter to God whether I look like an idolater or not. And Paul says, now, once you've done that, it's not about the burger, because idolatry is an issue. You mustn't give this Christian, this young, unformed Christian, this person with a weak conscience, we'll see what it means in a minute, but you mustn't give this person the impression that idolatry doesn't matter. If this person was an idolater, and might actually go back into idolatry, then it matters very much. Now, if they were not an idolater and they're never going back, then it doesn't matter. But if they were a real idolater and you're tempting them to go back and be that and they can't see the distinction, that's what he's getting at. For through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, the brother for whose sake Christ died. Meaning his faith is undermined, his faith is ruined. And thus, by sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. So, if food causes my brother to stumble, and that's what he means by stumble, the person's faith goes out from under them. They don't believe anymore. They don't trust Christ anymore. He says, well, then I will never eat meat again that I might not cause my brother to stumble. Now, Paul did eat meat again. We know it. He was not bothered by a lot of food laws. But he's speaking hyperbolically here. He's saying, look, if I'm with a person that I know is going to walk away from Jesus because I ate a steak that he knows was bought at the God Denny's, right? Well, then I just won't ever eat that again. It's as simple as that. Because I've prioritized his growth over my liberty, which is another thing that the Corinthians didn't do. See, they didn't prioritize anybody else's personal growth. It was just their own liberty they were interested in. But it wasn't about the food. It was about the idolatry. Now, what is a weak conscience? You got to know this. Listen up carefully. You got to know what a weak conscience is. If I were to say it, if I were to ask you, what is a weak conscience? I'll bet I would get a dozen different answers. The conscience in the Bible is a facility in the human soul that is left over from the creation, that is a moral compass. God has a moral compass that's perfect. You have a moral compass because you were created in his image. Yours isn't perfect. But it gives you an idea of the difference between right and wrong. That's conscience. Everybody has them. Now, consciences are not perfect in a fallen world. A conscience may be, Paul talks about seared consciences in 1 Timothy 4. It's possible to sear the conscience with bad teaching, meaning sear, by the way, we get our word cauterize from the word for that. Branded, seared, cooking flesh, that idea. A conscience can be scarred that way. There are people who do things and don't see anything wrong with it because their conscience is seared. And Paul talks about it in 1 Timothy 4. There are people who do not do things that they could do because their conscience is hypersensitive on something. But that is not the kind of weak conscience he's talking about here. This moral thing inside of his conscience can be altered and changed. You can have a strong, good, solid one informed by God's word, or you can have a seared one, or you can have a weak one. And the weak conscience is this, and take note carefully, it's the way to understand the passage. A weak conscience is one which is not actually sure what is right and wrong yet. Not actually sure. Now, in the case of idolatry, a weak conscience is a person who's not actually sure that they really want to be a monotheist. They came out of idolatry and they're changing their mind, but they're not exactly sure. They're sure enough to get baptized, they're sure enough to start walking with Jesus, but their conscience is not thoroughly formed. It hasn't set up. Do you ever pour concrete? You leave the forms on until the concrete sets. We all put our initials in the corner of the slab, right? You do that while it's soft, and then when it hardens, your initials are there for time and eternity. When they come in and they say, well, whoever poured this didn't know what they were doing. Oh, look, his name's right there. So, I always put someone else's name in the corner of the concrete. Here's the deal. When a person comes to Christ, their conscience, their ability to think about right and wrong begins to be reshaped, but it doesn't happen all at once. You don't become instantly mature. It sets. It takes time to set. Now, a person who was an idolater and who says, yeah, I believe in Jesus, I'm pretty sure. I've repented and I've thrown myself on the mercy of God. Cool. Baptize them. Bring them into the body of Christ. Let's teach them. Let's help them grow up. But that person still has this stuff to extricate from this old idolatry. If you do something that makes them think that idolatry might still be the way, and Jesus is just one of many, you see why Paul is upset about this? That's the key. The weak conscience. And that's the weak conscience. In a minute, I'll explain why it's important. If this person with a weak conscience goes back to idolatry, and is removed from the solid, stable confidence in one God, one Father, one Lord Jesus Christ. And this idolatry is brought into their life through another Christian whose mistaken idea about knowledge is that, hey, I can act like an idolater and it doesn't matter. Paul says that is a big, big problem among the Corinthians. All right, that's the end of the exposition. That's what the passage means. What does it mean to us? Let me give you three things. First, this. It means that the sin matrix of the culture does shape the way we live in it as Christians. The sin matrix, that means the way the culture experiences its idolatry. The culture has idolatry in it. When you identify what those idolatries are, that will shape some of the things that you as a Christian are going to need to watch out for, so that you don't become absorbed in the idolatries without thinking about them. The sin matrix of the culture actually does shape certain things Christians do under certain circumstances. Idols do not exist, but idolatry does, and that matters. Idolatry matters. So it's important to understand your culture. It's important to understand what you were saved from and what the other people around you were saved from, so that, and that's why, by the way, God uses people out of this culture to save other people in it, because you understand what you were saved from. He'll use you right where you were, you know, and he'll put you in line with other people who need to come out of the same, whatever the idolatry was. There's a sin matrix in every culture. Every culture has its gods. Our culture has Mammon, the god of money, and we have, well, we'll talk more about it as time goes by, but you just identify some of the cultural gods that we have that become more important than loyalty to the Lord. Just think about it. And then say to yourself, if I'm a Christian, how will I live in this sin matrix? Some people are saying, well, I got no problem living with the god Moloch. Well, yeah, that's because your culture doesn't worship Moloch. Your culture worships another god. How do you feel about that one? Well, that's not so bad. I was raised with that. Precisely. The sin matrix is part of how we understand how to be Christians in the culture. We look at the sin matrix and we go, okay, this is what our culture struggles with. Then I'm going to be very careful about these issues. Okay? Let me illustrate it by this. If you go to a costume party today and you wear a Nazi uniform, an SS officer uniform, people will probably say, wow, cool uniform, where'd you get that? But if you did that in 1946, your life would be in danger. And rightly so. You'd be the dumbest person on earth to wear a Nazi uniform to a party in 1946. Because after World War II, everybody realized in the matrix of the way sin worked for those 6 years, Nazism was at the heart of it. You don't dress up like a Nazi. What an idiot to do that. Okay. It's this way in our culture. Once you realize the culture's wrestling with a certain kind of warfare, you just don't play into that hand. Now, there is something else that builds on this. Here's the next statement. The first one is the sin matrix of the culture does shape the way we live when we want to be loyal to the Lord. Secondly, this means that some things are acceptable under some circumstances and not under others. This means that what might be okay today under certain circumstances might not be okay tomorrow when you're in another country, or vice versa, or when you're with another group. Now we're talking areas in which the Lord has not made a command. This is about food. Food doesn't matter, but idolatry does. And if the idolatry in the area you're with has to do with food, then you need to be careful what you eat when you're with those people. See? There are people say, oh, well, that's not consistent. You have to be consistent. Foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds. It's a famous statement. Foolish consistency. There are a lot of things that you do in the privacy of your home that you do not do outside the privacy of your home. And all God's people said, amen. And we're all very glad about this. Okay. Everybody knows that the context in which you are living makes a difference as to what you do. It is not inconsistent if it is an area that the Lord has left flexibility. It's not inconsistent for you to say, well, in this way, for evangelistic purposes, I need to limit my liberty over here. And over here in this situation, I don't need to. Paul says exactly that in chapter 9. Just read ahead. He says exactly the same thing. So we see where it's going. The sin matrix helps us understand how to live as Christians, but that means that some things are okay under some circumstances, not okay under others. He says, if they see you in that market. Now in chapter 10, he's going to say, hey, you want to buy some food? Go buy it, but don't ask them where it came from. Now, why would he say that? It's because under some circumstances, see. Here's the third statement. It is real love for the truly weak brother that shapes our liberty. Truly weak. Underline it, bold it, put little marks around it, make it look like it's lighting up on the paper. Truly weak. That's what Paul's worried about. The really weak one. The one whose conscience isn't fully formed. This is what limits the use of the liberty. And the reason I say this is because sometimes people make a profession of being offended at other Christians. He's not talking about hurting somebody's feelings who ought to know better. He is not talking about offending a legalist. In fact, he went out of his way to offend the legalists in Antioch. You read it in Galatians 2. Remember that when they had the church potluck? And the guys from Jerusalem came up and they're going, well, we only eat kosher, thank you very much. And a bunch of Gentiles had been there eating with their Jewish friends all along. Peter goes over and eats with his kosher buddies at the kosher table. And Paul looks at this and he goes, what's this? And he goes to the Gentile table purposely. And he says, I'll take a ham sandwich. Thank you very much. And he walks right over to the kosher guys and he's munching on his sandwich. And he says, well, Pete, what do you think of that? His purpose was to say, it's not about the food. See, Paul didn't care about legalists. He cared very much about weak consciences, especially among ex-pagans, who really needed to learn and have their theology stabilized as to who they were. So we're not talking here about offending a legalist. There are a lot of people who have micro-ethical issues. And here's the question to ask if you wonder. The question to ask is, well, are you upset about so-and-so doing such-and-so that you don't think they should do? Yes, I am. I'm offended. And don't you remember in the Bible it says if you offend a brother by your actions, then you shouldn't do it. Okay. Well, in this context in which this is said, what it means is that brother that is offended is going to walk away from Christ and become an idolater as a result of seeing this action. Is that what's going to happen to you? I've never heard the answer, yes, I'm afraid I'm going to be an idolater. Always when you hear this argument, you hear, well, of course not. Well, then you're not an offended brother, you're just a ticked off brother. And there's nothing in the Bible that says, thou shalt not tick off the brethren. But there isn't. It says, don't hurt a weaker brother. And so my question to that person is, look, if you're just ticked off because they're doing something and you can't find a biblical reason for them not to do it, you're just mad, why are you bothering me about it? Because it's not your hurting conscience, it's just that you're mad at them. This is not about offending a legalist. This is about really hurting a brother. Mature believers simply don't do things in a context where they know they will do one of two things, either demonstrate disloyalty to Christ in the culture, or encourage another younger believer to walk away from Jesus by this action. They will never do it. And I must say, as I say these things, I've never known a Christian in all my life of being a Christian. I've never known a Christian who, if they really knew that what they were saying or doing, it was a gray area thing, you know, if they really knew that it was going to desperately hurt the faith of another person, they wouldn't stop it in an instant. I've never known a Christian who purposely tried to hurt another person's faith. However, that is what was going on at Corinth, and it shows how immature they were. I found Christians to be willing to bend over backwards once they realize, if this is a situation, no problem. No problem. Once they realize it. The arguments come with the legalists, usually, practically speaking. Okay, three quick questions. And they're questions you have to answer, at least two of them. Here they are. It's a question for you. Is there meaningful evidence that I am loyal to Christ in my culture? When somebody gets to know me, is there any meaningful evidence in who I am, in what I do, in the way I do business, in the way I deal with the god Mammon, the god of our culture? Is there anything that when people get to know me, there's meaningful evidence that I am different? and that I am loyal to Christ? I can't answer that, but that's the question on the table. Because that's what he's after here. Meaningful evidence that you're not an idolater. Or am I indistinguishable from my culture once I leave church? Morally, ethically, spiritually, I look exactly like my culture, and there are no differences in my priority systems. Here's another question. How strong is my conscience? How easy is it to derail my faith? If I do see something that I think is terrible, am I going to not walk with Jesus? Is my faith fully formed? Has the concrete set? Do I really trust God? Do I really know there's only one and it's only through Christ? And if I'm real confident in that, how well am I in shape about this? How hard is it to knock me over in my faith? Or is it easy to knock me over? Do I sometimes wonder if it's worth serving Jesus or if I ought to go with the gods of the culture after all, the culture I was raised in? Do I sometimes wonder if it's not worth going to church? I'm not talking about bad weather, just it's not worth going to church. It's not worth being a Christian. Do I sometimes think that? That's actually a weak conscience. How strong is your conscience and can you build it? Because if everybody had as strong a conscience as the Lord desires for us, this whole issue would never have come up. So it's a good question. Here's the third question. If I do not worship God in Christ, does that mean I'm an idolater? Yes, it does. But I love God. I just don't want to go to church and be a Christian. I just don't believe in Jesus, but I love God. I think lots of warm thoughts about, lots of nice things about God, whoever he or she or it may be. Are you telling me I'm an idolater? Yeah. Frankly, yes. This is an exclusive relationship. You come to Jesus Christ, you belong to no one else. You owe all your loyalty to the Father through the Son. Pluralism is idolatry. And as a Christian, it's very tough in our culture to come to grips with that and to be in the conversations that bring that to the surface where people finally look at you and they say, what? You only believe in Jesus? Very narrow of you? And you can say, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, that brings up something that he actually said. Narrow is the way. It is. And when you're loyal to him and you know it and you make the commitment move and you say, I belong to him and only him, it clarifies all this stuff that Paul is dealing with here. I say that because next week is a baptism. If you've given your life to Jesus and you haven't been baptized, you should be baptized. It's the thing he said to do to be associated with him. And I encourage you to do it. I'm not going to have you walk forward here or anything, but I encourage you afterwards, come and talk to one of us and say, I want to be baptized next week. I want to belong to Jesus Christ first, last, and always. And if you've been a Christian a long time, you gave your life to the Lord a long time ago and you never got around to getting baptized, do it. Do it. It's a statement of your loyalty to him, and we encourage it very, very strongly. If you've already been baptized, you're a believer, you're walking with Christ, then take seriously what it means to live a life of loyalty. Father, thank you for these passages, sometimes misunderstood, a little difficult for us to grapple with at times. But we ask, Lord, that you would teach us how to live with loyalty and with a strong conscience, with a good understanding of who you are, that we might bring honor to your name. And we trust you for it, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.